You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
October 24th, 2020. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I am broadcasting, as always, from the Chicago suburbs. We've had some rain the past few days, but anyway, it seems like a dry day today. There are so many things going on. It is just, who would have guessed 6 months ago that things would be happening today that are happening. Anyway, Yahoo Groups is disappearing on December 15th, and we have quite a large group of individuals who follow me and who receive information about each and every program that I am on. And so if you wish to remain on the email notification list, you need to subscribe at groups.io/G/Deanna Spingola. I hate to be conspiratorial, but it just appears to me that a lot of the venues, a lot of the programs and sites that we have become accustomed to using in order to interact with each other are being sliced and diced. And so it's very difficult. For instance, this morning I went to my chat room and it wasn't there. I thought, oh my gosh. So what happened to the chat room? And I, in looking around, it was just kind of amazing. I found another chat room with my name on it that I did not create, but that somebody else created, and I was shocked at the things that were posted in that chat room. So anyway, I hope that that you will resubscribe, and I will send out notifications through Yahoo Groups up until the point that that they are no longer viable. Anyway, I'm glad that you joined me today, because I know there's lots of other things that you could be doing, like being under house arrest and those kinds of things. But I'm glad that you're here at republicbroadcasting.org. And we have a wonderful guest today that is going to talk about something that we have covered in the past, but that needs, well, it has been talked about. And a new book has been written about the subject of the Vince Foster murder, which was a murder. It was not a suicide. It doesn't matter what Wikipedia says. It was a murder. I always believed that it was a murder. Even before I read anything about it, I thought, the Clintons have done another one in. But anyway, you know where you can find the archives. I hope that you do know. Every week I explain, if you want to see who's been on the program, all you have to do is visit Spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button on the left, and you will be able to see the names of all the guests that I've had. You will be able to see the links to their websites. You will be able to contact them through those links. And so, it's pretty easy. But I still have people emailing me and said, how do I know who's going to be on? Or how do I know? Just go to spingola.com and click on the radio schedule button. I hope that you will also visit spingolaspeaks.net and screeningsandyhook.net. That's screeningsandyhook.net. I hope that you will join our chat room. It is back again and is viable. And that's Spingola, chattango.com. If you want to email a question, you may do that at comment@spingola.email. We will take calls maybe in the second hour. But our first guest today is Hugh Turley. Now, he is not the author of the book, The Murder of Vince Foster, but he's very much a part of the book. He's actually a character in the book. He knows the book forwards and backwards. And anyway, welcome to the program, Hugh.
Thank you. I think we've talked before.
Your name is very familiar. I think we've talked before.
We may have. I don't remember. I've done a lot of talk radio.
Exactly. Yes. Well, I'm glad that you're here. And it's just an amazing thing. You know Dave Martin, which I, DC Dave, a lot of people know him. And how did you happen to come in contact with him? How did you meet him? What is your relationship?
Well, we met, in 1994. We were introduced to each other by a man named Reed Irvine. Reed had a, media watchdog organization in Washington DC called Accuracy in Media, and he was the chairman. And he, I met him first, and then he was having a panel discussion, I think at the Army and Navy Club in Washington DC. And he said, "Why don't you come down? I've got some interesting people that are going to be here. There's, David Martin, and, there was an Ambrose Evans Pritchard was a journalist from England, and a couple of other people." And I went down, and I remember Dave recited one of his poems. He's, you know, does a lot of poetry, and he recited a poem called Solicitude. And it, I really liked the poem, and I asked him afterwards if I could have a copy of it. So he faxed it to me, because he didn't have a computer at the time. So I got a fax from him the next day, and then we started conversing at that point. But that we were introduced by Reed Irvine.
Interesting. I think that people are supposed to meet, I believe in that kind of thing, that people with like minds manage to somehow gather together so that they can meet and converse and, compare and evaluate. And that's what you've done, right?
I kind of have my own theory about that, because I studied philosophy in college, and, Aristotle talked about chance and meeting by chance, and he gave an example of a master sent his servant to the market, and then he sent another servant to get something else to the market. The two servants ran into each other at the market, and they thought it was by chance that they met. They said, "Oh, well, look at what you're doing here." And for the servants, it was by chance, but for the master, it was by design.
Ah.
So I think Dave and I met, perhaps
by
for
design.
Us, it was by chance, but maybe God had a bigger plan.
I believe that. I really do. I think that.
I often think that. When that's how I met Reed, too. I should tell you how I met Reed Irvine, because I'm professionally a magician, and I deceive people for a living. I tell people I do that in Washington. They all think I work for the government, but I tell them there's a difference, because I tell you that I'm going to deceive you before I do it. But anyway, I had done a show over in Northern Virginia, and I was on my way back home, and at the time, the O.J. Simpson news was on all of the radio stations, talking about the white Ford Bronco and all of the bloody glove and so on, and endlessly, and no matter what station you put on, that's what you were going to listen to. And I remembered that this man, Vincent Foster, died at a park in Virginia, and I thought, well, you know, I'm near that park, and I've never been in there. And I thought, I think I'll go in and just take a look around. And I walked into the woods, and there I met Reed Irvine, who was investigating the case himself, and he was in park. So, again, maybe for the servants it was by chance, but for the master it was by design. But we both sort of were in the park at the same time. That was the chance meeting that ended up introducing me to David Martin.
Amazing. I really don't think it was by chance. I really believe that synchronicity had a big part in that. I think that you were meant to meet. And I believe that there are a lot of people that I have interviewed, that I've been honored to interview. It's not by chance that we converse and share ideas, but it's meant to be. And I feel honored to have met a lot of the people that I've met.
Yeah, well, it changed my life that day because it set me on I just had more questions. I just wanted to, I wanted to know where the body was found that day. I asked Reed Irvine, I said, where was the body found? And he said, well, some people say it was over here and some people say it was over there. And I said, well, it was a year ago. I said, you tell me they don't know where the body was even found? And he said, well, come by my office tomorrow and I'll give you some documents that I have from the park police and you can read up on it. And that got me started. And of course, David Martin was interested long before me. He was really one of the first people on this case because he went to college with Vince Foster at Davidson in North Carolina. And they were in the Young Democrat Club together. And I think they played intramural basketball. They weren't close friends, but Dave Martin knew him. Mm-hmm. And when he died, right away, he thought, this doesn't make sense. It just doesn't, he didn't think he would kill himself. And Martin is a very good thinker, a very good critical thinker. And he read the news accounts. And I know that one of the first stories that came out that he read, just puzzled him. It said that the police went to the Foster home the night of the death, but they were turned away because the family was too distraught to talk to them. And he said to himself, this doesn't make sense. I mean, how do you turn the police away when they're doing a death investigation? He said, I don't think that's possible. And he also thought that, you know, the family would want to know what happened to their loved ones, so they would want to talk to the police to find out what they knew. So typically when police give a notification to a family, from the police perspective, it's also an opportunity to do an interview with the family and find out what they know and what their thoughts were about this, you know, to death. So it only made sense to Martin that the police would really need to talk to that family. So the next day he called the park police and spoke to one of the senior officers. I think it was Major Hines, but he got through and he asked him, he said, well, I read in the paper that the police were turned away. He said, that can't be true, is it? And he said, no, actually, he said, we went back the next morning and interviewed the family. Well, that was also a lie because it would be a year later in the summer of 94. There were some hearings before the Senate and the park police officers testified about the night of the death and what they did. And they actually said then that they interviewed the family for over an hour. So now you want to know, well, what did the family tell them? That we weren't even told that they talked to the family. So Dave Martin, from the very early news reports, was already on the phone calling the park police and doing his own, you know, detective work and trying to find out what happened. And he was reading the papers very critically. And of course, the early reports in the paper that he read said that the family said Foster was not depressed. And stories started to change, and then they said, well, no, he was depressed. Well, Martin, right away, Dave Martin keyed in on the news media, and he was aware that the media was sifting the facts back and forth, and he was before anybody else, I think he was ahead of everybody in investigating this matter. So by the time I met him, it was a year later, and he had digested quite a bit already. And I was just kind of new, breaking into finding my way. But my contribution was primarily looking at documents and sifting through official records from the investigations and finding things in there. And then, of course, I would share things with him, and he would write articles. But he always came back to the press. They were the real villains behind the cover-up. So, I mean, we don't know who killed Mr. Foster or why, and those are two questions that are always asked, who did it and why. But we know who covered it up. It was the news media and primarily a gentleman named Christopher Ruddy, and we can get into him later if you want, tell you all about him. He used to stay at my house.
Oh.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Well, you know, you can attract some bad people if you seek the truth.
Right.
I mean, it kind of brought me back into my Christian faith when I got through this whole thing, but I now understand why there was a Judas Iscariot among the 12 in the boat, because, mm-hmm. you know, nowadays it's Christopher Ruddy, but scripture is sort of a prophetic interpretation of our present reality.
Yes, it does seem to be.
Yes. I mean, the characters, they might have different faces and names, but they're here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's just, of course, I think, personally, I think it was the Clintons that did it.
I don't think so, Deanna. Nothing points to that. In fact, they were actually quite surprised when Foster died. They were really surprised. In fact, Hillary said at the time that of 1,000 people that would commit suicide, he's the last one she thought would commit suicide. And Bill Clinton was on the Larry King show that night. They were quite shocked and surprised. Mm. But I think they did participate in the cover up, but because they weren't interested in finding out what happened. I would say they're definitely guilty of that, but as far as the crime itself, I don't think anything points to the Clintons. Now this has been used as a distraction because the public has been given two choices. Vince Foster committed suicide, and some people believe that. And other people say the Clintons did it. And actually, neither one of those are correct. But they've got the public fooled either way. You take your choice, but it's what we call in my business the magician's choice.
Right.
Neither choice is the right choice. Foster was certainly murdered, but he was probably murdered for something very dark and very evil. And it involves Republicans and Democrats because the Republicans and Democrats covered it up. And, it's not just the Clintons. It's, you know, Kenneth Starr was a Republican and Dan Burton had the oversight committee, when they took the House of Representatives
right.
in 1996. And he could have done something, but he didn't.
Wow.
It's very, whatever it was, it's very dark.
Okay, we are going to a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts.
All righty, we are back. And our first guest today is Hugh Turley, and he's giving us some incredible information about Dave Martin, what Dave Martin discovered and surmised. And I think that I kind of assumed that it was probably the Clintons because they have such a long list of people that they've supposedly killed. And Dean Arnold, in his book, kind of surmised that it was Hillary that had him.
Right.
Off.
You know, I used Dean on your show. I know Dean.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yes, he's a very nice man. Very nice, yeah. He wrote that book, of course, when Hillary was running for president. So it was, I think he was trying to look at that direction. And of course, a lot of people were interested in looking in that direction. But there was, you know, I really dealt with evidence and facts and all of the evidence that I found. And I found, I mean, I've been through tens of thousands of pages of documents, and I've been through the National Archives, everything that's publicly available I've seen. And I can tell you that there isn't anything that points to the Clintons, except one person liked to point to the Clintons who was steering us away from the truth, and that was Christopher Ruddy. And he liked to point to the Clintons a lot. In fact, he's probably more responsible than anybody in making the suspicion fall on the Clintons. Now, I don't really like the Clintons, and I'm not a big fan of theirs, but I wouldn't stick this on. What I would stick on them is that they covered it up, and they had responsibility to speak up, and with all the evidence that we dug up, I mean, they should have been our friends. But to go back on I want to touch on Dave Martin again, because he wrote a poem that I like very much called Overdoing Learning. And it's about the Republicans and Democrats together. It goes like this. Could it be I've learned too much? If charged, I must confess. My views would be more popular if I knew much less. I could vote for Democrats or for the GOP and not have old acquaintances almost run from me. Education's big with them and ignorance the foe, except for those disturbing things that they don't want to know.
Wow.
And when I was helping Dave and this witness, Patrick Knowlton, and his attorney and so on during this case, lots of invitations came from Republican groups, and I could speak to the Republican group here and the Republican group there, and most of the allies looking for the truth about Foster were Republican groups because they thought it was the Clintons. And it's interesting that, you know, once the Clintons were out of power, nobody was interested in the Foster case anymore on the Republican side. You couldn't get a speaking engagement. It just wasn't there. But the Clintons are still here.
Right.
And so are the Republicans that covered it up. I mean, the guy, Christopher Ruddy at the time, he was a journalist who was a critic of the official investigations. And, he was always pointing the finger at the Clintons and the Park Police as responsible for the cover up.
So well, you have today, to question that and say, well, why?
Well, now Mr. Ruddy is a good friend of the Clintons.
What's going on here? Yeah.
Yeah, he's also an advisor to Donald Trump.
Yikes.
So
that's scary.
He sort of changed teams, you know, at the beginning, everybody thought he was interested in the truth about the case, and it looked like he was a good guy, and Martin's book treats him that way in the beginning. David Martin's book is subtitled America's Would-Be Dreyfus Affair.
Right.
And in France, there was this affair where there was a cover-up of an innocent man was convicted of a crime he didn't commit, and actually it was Christopher Ruddy that told Dave Martin he should write about it. So he dedicated his book to Christopher Ruddy.
Wow.
One of the arch villains. But Ruddy was, always pointing the finger at the Clintons, and then suddenly he became a friend of the Clintons. And you wonder what's going on here? What is going on?
Well, there are so many people that point the finger at the Clintons whenever somebody is, somebody close to them is killed, and there have been so many. It was a very good assumption. Yeah. Oh, it was probably them. It's probably another one of their kills. But.
There's a lot of criminal activity around the Clintons.
Right.
More accurate. I mean, there were a lot, there was this Mena, Arkansas drug dealing.
Drug running and all that, yeah.
And you know, gangsters, as you know, kill gangsters. So, Mr. Foster was hanging around with some pretty creepy people. And so, it's, you know, why, you know, that this kind of happens, but the gangsters don't scream bomber.
Right. All right, here we are going to go to a 3-minute break. We will be right back.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, we are back with our guest, Hugh Turley, and we are talking about Dave Martin's new book, and the title of that book is The Murder of Vince Foster, America's Would-Be Dreyfus Affair. Dreyfus Affair. And it's a very comprehensive book. It's quite thick. It's amazing. And I've been aware of Dave Martin for a long time. I've interviewed him numerous times, and he's always been a joy to have on the program. And you are also. I'm very happy to have you on the program.
Thank you.
His stead today. And definitely, I'm sure he's listening. So hi, Dave. anyway, I there was such an effort, and people just automatically figured, well, it's the Clintons, but as you say, probably wasn't, because they were more surprised than...
Yeah. I want to go further on this, because I think it's a good point, because so many people believe it's the Clintons, and let me explain exactly why we know it isn't. And besides the fact there's any evidence saying they did, I'll tell you why we know that they didn't. Is if in Dave Martin's book, he really zeroes in on the news media and the cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two really pivotal people in this case. One of them was named Miguel Rodriguez, who was a U.S. attorney. He worked in Kenneth Starr's Office of Independent Counsel, and he was in charge of the Vincent Foster death investigation. And he uncovered evidence of a murder. And he documented it. There's a memorandum that he wrote, a 30-page memorandum. It's in the back of Dave's book. His resignation letter's in there as well. And then he also spoke to Reed Irvine, who I mentioned earlier, the chairman of Accuracy and Media. Well, now, Reed tape recorded all of his phone conversations. He did that methodically, and it was legal in the District of Columbia to tape phone conversations. So he always taped his conversations. And we found several tapes that Reed had with conversations with Miguel Rodriguez. This man said that he spoke to over 100 journalists and tried to get the word out. He spoke to Steve Labaton of the New York Times for 6 hours. He spoke to journalists at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Wall Street Journal. You name it, he went to everybody, and nobody would cover this story.
And wow.
So now, you know, the Clintons have a lot of friends, but they don't control the news media.
Right.
The Clintons are not in charge of the news media. But that's why we know that they didn't orchestrate the cover-up. The news media did. And the other person that's very important is Patrick Knowlton and his attorney, John Clark. Now, Patrick was an actual witness in the case. And we
right.
can talk more about these men later. But just briefly, he and his attorney were able to get the U.S. Court of Appeals 3-judge panel that appointed Kenneth Starr to attach 20 pages of evidence of a cover-up by Starr's own staff. And this was included as part of the final report on the death of Vincent Foster. Now, this is the first time in the history of the United States that an independent counsel had evidence of a cover-up by his own staff included in his report. So this was huge news. I think Dave Martin called it the suppression of 97, because it was on October 10th, 1997 that this report was released to the public. And the entire news media reported that Starr's report on Foster's death had been released. And I mean, you could pick up a paper from Maine to San Diego to Keokuk, Iowa, and everywhere in between. And every paper said Starr's report has been released and the verdict was suicide, and it's a 114-page report. Well, that's a big lie.
Right.
Because the report was actually 137 pages, but the news media left off the final appendix.
Right.
They have never, ever, even to this day, reported that there's an appendix to the report. Now, as much as people might not like the Clintons don't have the power to stop the St. Paul Pioneer Press in Minnesota, where I'm from publishing this story. And I actually was there the day the report was released, and I had a copy of the appendix because it was under seal, and I gave it to a woman at the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Her name was Martha Malin, and in Dave's book, he's created a word out of her name. It means to malinize.
I mean, he's always making up words.
Woman, I spent a half an hour with her, and I showed her what was going to be in the report. I said, you can report this before anybody in D.C. I said, you can scoop the country. Well, they didn't report it. And Patrick and John, the attorney and his client, went down to the Associated Press here in Washington. There's a gatekeeper there named Pete Yost. And Pete was the guy that lets the stories out and doesn't let other stories, you know, they just are suppressed. And Patrick and John had a court order. They knew this was going to be attached to Starr's report. And they went down to give him a heads up. And they said, Pete, we're going to show you this. It's under seal by the court, but we want you to know what's coming because we're going to help you with your journalism job. And, you know, they were like, here it is. This is the 20 pages attached to the report. Here's the court order attaching it. And he told them the story's going to be suicide. And they couldn't believe it. They were shocked. They said, no, Pete, you don't understand. Look, you see, this is the appendix, and this is the court order. When the report is released, this will be included. And Pete said, no, you don't understand. And this is his exact words. He said, the story is already written. It's in the can upstairs. That's what he told them. And they didn't believe him. They left his office, and they thought, you know, he didn't get it. Well, the fact was they didn't get it, because when the news broke and the report came out, nobody mentioned the appendix. NBC News is the only news outlet that called John Clark, the attorney. They called him that morning and they said, are you the attorney that attached this appendix to the report? He said, yes, I am. He thought he was going to get an interview. And they just said, wow, and hung up.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, the Clintons didn't do that.
No.
Clintons don't go over to the Associated Press and tell Pete Yost what to do. The Clintons are not in charge of the news media. But the news media was in charge of the cover-up, because even when a key witness and the lead investigator on the case try to blow the whistle and let the American people know that there's a cover-up of a murder going on here. In fact, the lead investigator, Miguel Rodriguez, in his memorandum, he wrote in there that the police, and he names them, Officer Simonello, Officer Cheryl Brown, and Officer John Rolla, brought the gun to Fort Marcy Park and placed it in Fort Vincent Foster's hand, and then they re-photographed the body.
Right.
Now, the Clintons didn't orchestrate that,
no.
Okay? And the FBI has been in this up to their eyeballs. I mean, the FBI has been part of the cover-up from the very beginning, the night of the death, and they have harassed and intimidated witnesses. They've falsified reports. And the Miguel Rodriguez wrote this in his resignation letter to Ken Starr. He said, the FBI has falsified witness statements. Now, all of this kind of shenanigans, and then you got the House and the Senate, Republicans like Newt Gingrich, Dan Burton, all of them. Ken Starr, a nice Republican. Brett Kavanaugh, who's on the Supreme Court, took the place of Miguel Rodriguez.
Yes.
And he wrote the fraudulent report, the first 114 pages. And the Republicans love him. He's on the Supreme Court, and he's part of an ongoing cover-up of a murder. Kavanaugh should be behind bars. But when his hearing came up, none of the Democrats said a thing about this. And none of the Republicans.
Yes, and they could have.
They could have if they didn't want him on the court.
Exactly.
But both parties are in this together. But when they have us thinking it's the Clintons, we're missing the big picture, see?
Sure.
And if you're
focused not going to look
Clintons,
any further.
Well, you're not. But see, it's, you can't just look at the Clintons. The Clintons did their own part by not speaking up, and they should have. But they're no different than the rest of these animals here in Washington. And I'm sorry to say, it also includes Donald Trump, who's a friend of Christopher Ruddy's, who at Ruddy's advice appointed Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. I mean, it's bigger than the Clintons.
Yes, you're right.
They're in
Absolutely.
It. I mean, they're in it, but if you just look at them, you're going to miss the rest of it.
Wow. Which is the whole point of blaming them?
Oh, of course it's the whole point of blaming them.
Sure.
It just makes it a left-right issue.
Sure.
That all Republicans will think it's the Clintons, and all the Democrats will say suicide, and neither side is correct.
Right.
And that's the way, it's what I called in the beginning, in my profession as a professional magician, we call it the magician's choice. You know, pick whichever one you want, but it doesn't matter because you're going to lose.
Right, because it's the third choice.
It's the choice not offered.
Right.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. And of course, now, Christopher Ruddy, he's Newsmax CEO.
That's right. I've got to read something to you. This is a line out of Dave's book it's one of my favorite in the whole book. It's about how Ruddy transformed himself, because when he was looking into the case, they said he was a conspiracy theorist.
Okay, now what page are you on?
Well, it's page 310.
Okay.
It's under the heading Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And Dave writes this. He says, now let's fast forward to July 2018. From the perspective of America's mainstream press, the ugly caterpillar of a conspiracy theorist, Ruddy, had wondrously metamorphosized, in contrast to his actual appearance, into a respectable, influential butterfly of a much respect and a much respected CEO and one of Trump's closest confidants, as Politico calls him. So that just describes Ruddy perfectly. And you know what Dave says, you know, one might think that this guy changed, but he was always the same Christopher Ruddy. He was always a deceiver. He used to come to my house when he came to Washington. He slept in my house. He ate at my table.
Oh my gosh.
And, Ruddy. You're okay still. Real figure. I remember the night I met him. It was another occasion when Reed Irvine introduced me to somebody, because it was, Reed introduced me to David Martin, but I was, Reed asked me to come down to Chinatown, and we were at a place called the China Doll Restaurant, and you wouldn't believe who was sitting at my table. Reed was there, and he and I were probably the only honorable men at the table. There was another guy named Jack Wheeler. Do you know Dr. Jack Wheeler?
No.
Oh, he's a character. You can Google him up. But he was called by the Wall Street Journal a real live Indiana Jones. I think he was on I've Got a Secret, if you remember that old TV show back in the day.
Yes, yes.
He was on that show with Steve Allen when he was 19 years old. He climbed the Matterhorn, I think, when he was 14, swam the Hellespont. He was the youngest Boy Scout to get an Eagle Award. Anyway, he's sitting on my left-hand side. Joe Golden, who I found out later, was the executor of the will of David Attlee Phillips. Now, David Attlee Phillips, if people don't know, also had an alias. His name was Maurice Bishop, and he was often seen with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Wow.
Well, anyway, Golden's sitting on, he's the executor of Attlee Phillips' will when he died. He's next to me, and Congressman Dana Rohrabacher from California was there, and right across from me was Christopher Ruddy, and I met him for the first time that night, and he already knew who I was.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's when I met him, and I was, of course, I thought he was just the greatest thing. I thought he was this wonderful journalist who was going to get to the truth and everything. But my wife told me when she saw him, she said, "I don't like his face." I said, "Well, you don't even know him." And she said, "He's not a good man." And I used to argue with my wife because I didn't understand this thing called women's intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, she doesn't know him. Well, she did. And I learned that when my wife tells me that somebody's got a bad face, she knows what she's talking about.
Yes.
And she had him
there.
And I'll tell you a side story. This Dave Martin's wife told him the same thing.
Mm.
He told his wife that Christopher Ruddy was a saint.
Oh my gosh.
His wife said, "Don't trust him." Well, our wives were right and we were wrong. But that's pretty typical. Well, we learned.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy. Mm. I love all the poems and just the, when you go through the book, I haven't gone through the whole book. Obviously, I just got it like 4 days ago.
Yeah, it's a big book.
Yeah,
it was easy for me because I'm a character in the book. I know the whole story already.
Right.
It's nice to read Dave's take on it, and also his poetry is throughout the book. And
exactly.
I love his little poems. They just nail it. There's a thing that was, I have to tell you this because this is a thing that comes up a lot, and there was a journalist, he's still around, called Michael Isikoff. He was the one that wrote that story I told you about that said the police were turned away from the foster home. He wrote that story.
Wow.
And probably knew it wasn't true. But he, I heard him speak one time, and he said that if there was a cover-up of Foster's murder, everybody would have to know about it. He said, you know, there'd be too many people involved because you see, you have the FBI involved, you have the park police involved, the Clintons would be involved, and the autopsy doctor. He said, I just can't believe that all these people would be involved in a conspiracy. So I can't, you know, if you want to believe a conspiracy theory, you have to believe that. Otherwise, the guy killed himself. So that was the way it was presented to the public, that all these people have to be involved. Well, Miguel Rodriguez, the lead investigator, answered that question very nicely. And as I said, he was in charge of the investigation. And he said, when people think there's a large conspiracy, they're wrong. He said, you don't need a lot of people involved. You don't need everybody to know what everybody's doing. He yeah. said, when you cover up something like this, he said, all you need is a few people at the top. So he said, when the Park Police write their reports, you gather them all together, you change them to fit whatever you want the outcome to be. And he said, if somebody catches you, he says, so what? He says, nobody's going to report it anyway. So there isn't a big conspiracy where all these people are involved. And what they're doing, what people do, it's just human nature, is that they just don't want to embarrass their colleagues who've reached their conclusions already.
Right. And everybody they don't want to get involved.
Everybody keeps their mouth shut. Now, Dave has a wonderful poem about this, and I think it's based on one of the Psalms, but it's called Look Up, and Dave called it the Look Up Factor. And here, I got to read it to you, because this is how the cover-up occurs without a great conspiracy. It goes like this. Look up to the organization with proper awe and fear. Bow down to your earthly betters and safeguard your career. Neither sun nor moon will smite you in daytime or at night if you keep your waters waveless, regardless of what you like. We'll come back and do this.
Okay, we'll be right back. Okay. With our guest, Hugh Turley, and you were just starting out to share one of Dave's poems.
Yeah.
Which are always so incredible.
Yeah. Well, this one explains why you don't need a great conspiracy, because the cover-up people say, well, if there was a cover-up, you didn't need a conspiracy. Well, you don't need a conspiracy, and it's called the look-up factor. Here it is. Look up to the organization with proper awe and fear, bow down to your earthly betters and safeguard your career. Neither sun nor moon will smite you in daytime or at night if you keep your waters waveless, regardless of what's right. Your temporal protectors will neither slumber nor sleep as long as you are one with the company you keep. With sovereignty unchecked by any higher power, the purposeful collective displays its finest flower. That purpose is whatever our vulgar fancy wills when no one's eyes are lifted unto the psalmist's hills. Now, that poem it translates into real life when you look at what happened to Christopher Ruddy. Here's this journalist who was a critic on the case. Now he's the CEO of Newsmax, and he's worth millions and millions and millions of dollars, and he's a friend of the Clintons and the Trumps. Another guy that was also in that office of independent counsel, of course, was Brett Kavanaugh, who's risen to the Supreme Court. And another man that was in that office is Alex Azar. He's now head of Health and Human Services.
Yikes.
He may be giving us a vaccine very shortly. But these people that are part of the cover-up, their careers have risen up, see? And they all, another one, look at George Stephanopoulos. He was in the Clinton White House. He was with Clinton the night of Foster's death. He's got his own big news talking head show on Sunday. All of the criminals have risen up. And I noticed this when I was doing my research on the case, because I would read all of these reports of the police officers, the firefighters, the paramedics, and everybody. And when I would read them, the people that were the privates and the low-level people, their statements had the ring of truth. And the further up the ladder you got, the captains and lieutenants, I mean, they just couldn't tell the truth of their life depended on it. But that's why they got promoted. I mean, right. People rise up if they're willing to go along with the organization. So you don't need a conspiracy theory. Everybody knows how the game is played. And each person falls in line and does their duty. They are a good soldier and they do what you're supposed to do to get ahead. So wow. That's how it works. It's there is no great conspiracy.
Wow.
It's just human nature and sin.
Now you mentioned you emailed me that you just had a friend drop in.
I did have to have someone come in. He was a very pivotal player in this whole case. His name is John H. Clark. Now John was the attorney for Patrick Knowlton.
Oh my gosh. And he just happened to drop in.
He comes over all the time. trying to get into my refrigerator or something. But anyway, he's a really nice man, and he's probably done 200 or 300 talk radio shows before. He knows all about this case because he's the one that was responsible for getting the appendix attached to the report. He saw a loophole in that independent counsel statute that people that were named in the report could make a comment. And even though his client was named,
okay, we're at the top of the hour. See if we can get him hooked up with on an extension or on a telephone, okay?
Okay.
You're on Skype, but he can be on your phone, okay? Talk to the producer. Be right back.
Public Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests, and now we have another, an additional guest. Kind of a bonus is our Hugh Turley, our original guest, and John Clark, that's C-L-A-R-K-E, who is another hero in Dave Martin's book, who just happened to drop into Hugh's house. And Hugh says it's because he wanted to look in his refrigerator, but we'll let that pass. John, welcome to the program also.
Well, thank you. Hi, Diana. Is it Deanna?
Deanna, huh?
Yeah. Well, fortuitous that I happen to stop by at this time. I'm happy to be on.
Yes, it's great. That it's a bonus, really, absolutely. And so, you are also in Dave Martin's book. And what part did you play in the situation that occurred in the death of Vince Foster? What can you tell us?
I had the pleasure of and the honor of representing Patrick Knowlton, who was an acquaintance of mine at the time, and we lived in the same building, and I kind of got involved. I was in the process of changing from criminal defense work to the civil work, and so I had some time. And it's a good thing I did because I sort of jumped in with both feet and worked full time. So I was not here for the initial conversation that you had with Hugh, so forgive me if I repeat some things, but just a couple of things I want to sort of put forward. I did hear Hugh mention about the 20 pages that was ordered attached to Ken Starr's report on the death of Vincent Foster. Now that was in the history of the independent counsel statute, that's the only time that a independent counsel was ordered to attach evidence of a cover-up by his own investigators to his own report. And that was, sadly, pretty much a news blackout. And the other, sort of point that I'd like to make, that I make on a regular basis is, whether or not we care about this, murder cover-up. And I think that we should care. And not so much because of government corruption, although that is important, but it also tells us that we can't rely on the news media to report these things, these cover-ups and crimes, even when their existence is absolutely obvious. And we can't, we have a separation of powers doctrine in this country. The Constitution separates the powers into various branches, and one branch is supposed to exercise oversight over the other, and that has 100% totally failed in this case. So again, I think that's why that this is such an important thing for to be brought to light.
Right. And how fortuitous it was that you happened to be an attorney and that you happened to be available and living within Patrick Nolson's building, which that is amazing.
Yes, it was very amazing. I'll tell you just a story with that, Deanna. John and Pat had told me that Patrick used to run into John in the laundry room of the apartment building. He'd say, "I've got a friend that needs a will." And John said, "I don't do wills." He said, "Well, I have a friend that's getting divorced." John said, "I don't do divorce." And then he said, "Well, what do you do?" He said, "Well, I've been doing criminal law." Well, Patrick became a witness in this case, and then I haven't told anybody about it yet, but John, I think I'm going to let him tell you about this witness intimidation that Patrick, his client, suffered when he was subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury. And at that point, Patrick found an avenue where John did practice law, and that's how they ended up together. But they lived right above each other in this building and knew each other, but then they became working together all the way to the Supreme Court. John, why don't you tell Deanna, I didn't tell her anything about the witness intimidation and about what Patrick saw at the park or any of that.
Oh, right. Yeah, I read about what he...
Why he's important.
Why he was there in the park and from another book. But, yes, please tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Patrick was driving out to his a property. He had an ownership interest out in the country, and he was on George Washington Memorial Parkway leaving Washington, D.C., driving out to the country, backed up in traffic, and he had to relieve himself. He had to urinate. So there was a sign there for Fort Marcy Park, and he pulled into the park, into the parking lot, and it's a small banana-shaped parking lot with about 20 spaces, and numbering the spaces 1 through 20. The first space was a car, or actually I guess the fourth space was a car that was an older brown Honda. And then two spaces down from that was a newer car. This was, again, in 1993, so I say newer car. It was newer, the older one that he saw. We did learn later that it was either 1983 or 1984. And anyway, Patrick pulled in to the left of the first spot. Of number five spot. He pulled into right around number one spot, and he got out to walk into the first large tree. And when he did, he noticed that the person that was parked not the Arkansas car, but the car that was about in spot whatever it was, six or seven, there was a man in there, and he put down his window and stared at Patrick. And then when Patrick got out of his car and was getting ready to walk into the park to find, again, the first large tree, this guy got out and leaned on the top of his car, just kind of stared at him kind of intently. So Patrick kind of feigned to read the sign and looked over, and there was the guy still staring at him. But he figured, well, you know, you got to go. So he went in urinated on a tree, and he was walking back. He heard the car door close. So Patrick's sort of he's a New Yorker. He's kind of a well aware of his surroundings kind of person. And so he walked back very slowly. He didn't know where the guy was. The car door closed. He didn't know if the guy was coming after him. He didn't know that maybe the guy was crouched on the other side of the older Honda. He just didn't know. So he had sort of a heightened sense of awareness. And as he walked back, he walked right next to this brown Honda and used it sort of as a buffer in case the guy was hiding on the other side of the car, was going to jump out.
Sure.
And he walked around the back of the Honda and noticed that the guy had this guy who had been staring at him was back in his car, still staring at him. And in the event, Patrick got back in his car and then drove away. And that was the full, that was what happened to him. And so then later, 9 months later, the FBI, he called that day or that evening about midnight. He saw in the news that Vince Foster's body had been found in Fort Marcy Park in the afternoon, and he had been there between 4:30, pulled into 4:30, he was there for 5 minutes, and pulled out at 4:35. So he called the park police, and they just sort of took some notes, but nobody came to interview him. And then until 9 months later, the FBI came to interview him, tried to convince him that the car that he saw was Vince Foster's car, showing him photographs over and over again. Two back-to-back interviews, and that was the primary focus of the interviews, and they were unable to do so, so they just lied and said that he identified it as a 1988 to 1990 Honda, and Vince Foster's car happened to be 1989.
But and they were different colors.
He had a heightened sense of awareness. He recognized, he remembered, the because of the guy was staring at him, he remembered that the car was older and that it was brown. It was not the silver gray Honda. In any event, the second FBI interview, he went to the, they took him to the FBI lab, it's kind of a big mistake, and asked him if he could pick out the car color panels, and it was a very distinctive, dull color. And he picked it out, and it corresponded only to Hondas, only for the years 1983 to 1984. So in any event, that was it. He just kind of went about his business. And then now 18 months later after the death, he was contacted by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who is a journalist with the London Sunday Telegraph. He was the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the London Telegraph. And interviewed him, and Patrick told him what happened, and Ambrose was kind of shocked and showed him his FBI's recently declassified FBI 302 reports, which are interview reports, and Patrick said, this is all lies. So then Ambrose wrote an article, which appeared in the London Sunday Telegraph, Death in the Park, Is This the Killer?, with a police sketch artist of a rendition of this person that he saw in the park and his whole story, and it made a lot of fun of made light of Ken Starson. They didn't even talk to this guy, you know. So in any event, that newspaper appeared in U.S. newsstands on a Wednesday, and on a Tuesday, and that same Tuesday, the Office of Independent Counsel and the FBI prepared a subpoena for Patrick to testify before the Whitewater Grand Jury, but they held it for 2 days until Thursday, and they served him on Thursday. He was he took one of his usual walks with his girlfriend, now his wife, Kathy, from the Foggy Bottom neighborhood to the DuPont Circle neighborhood, about 6, 7, 8 blocks, something like that. And they talked about over the phone where they were going to go, and they were taking their walk. And Patrick was harassed. He was followed by back-to-back-to-back men staring at him, following him right next to him, just lock-eyed stare on his face, back-to-back. Now, it doesn't really make sound that much, but if this happens to you, if it were to happen to somebody, it really can be quite overwhelming. In fact, they're on one side of Connecticut Avenue at DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., after having been harassed by 7 or 8 of these men, and we'll just cross the street. And so they crossed Connecticut Avenue, and they get halfway across, and there's another man on the other side of the street, same lock-eyed stare, staring at him. Kathy started to cry. I mean, she had to really struggle to withhold from crying. It was really quite amazing. So this happened the balance of the day. That evening, people were banging on his door. They were calling him in the middle of the night. And it happened. The same thing happened the next day, and there were 25 men altogether. And that the recitation of what I just told you was among the other things that was ordered to be attached to the Office of Independent to Ken Starr's report on the death of Vincent Foster, because we submitted that attachment approving 6 areas of an FBI cover-up. Again, the 3-judge Court of Appeals panel ordered Ken Starr to attach it. He filed a motion to reconsider, and that was immediately denied, and it was attached. And again, the only time in the history of the U.S. of the Independent Counsel statute that an Independent Counsel was ordered to attach evidence of a cover-up by his own investigators to his own report, and not one word of it came out in the press.
Oh my gosh. That is, who decided this? Who's the top, of course.
Well, Brett Kavanaugh was involved. He was one of, he signed the subpoena.
Yeah, he signed the subpoena. It's in our submission. We later went through when the after the independent counsel's report was released, We could read it, and we went through it. We spent 18 months going through it, and this might, it may sound incredible, but out of the about 80 or so little, you know, small points of evidence that Kavanaugh wrote, not one of them is true. I mean, we compared it to the underlying federal investigative record, like 10,000 pages, and there's just nothing in there that is true. Mr. Foster had a bullet wound in his neck. The powder burns, right, among other, the most stark evidence that I could, that to me, was the fact that the powder debris on his hands shows into the web of his thumb, between his thumb and his forefinger, showed that he could not have pulled the trigger. It would just be impossible. He just couldn't do it. And then one more thing I'd like to point out. Yeah, just one more thing. We've heard, and the news media has told us, that there are five separate investigations into the case, and that is just simply not true. There has been one investigation into this case under different titles. First, it was the Park Police, the U.S. and with the FBI, but you wouldn't know about the FBI. And the Park Police essentially didn't investigate. I mean, they didn't even test the weapon before they killed Cooley's suicide. And then there was Robert Fisk. That was the FBI. Then Robert Fisk was replaced by Kenneth Starr. That was the FBI. In fact, it was the exact same FBI agents who worked under Robert Fisk. And that's the three police investigations. And then the news media would have us believe that there were two congressional investigations. That's not true either. The 1994 Senate Banking Committee had a statement of jurisdiction, and the only thing that they were going to look into, it was Resolution 229, the only thing that they could look into was whether or not the Park Police, the White House improperly influenced the Park Police. Well, it wasn't a Park Police investigation, and who cares whether or not White House was, you know, exercised improper influence. And the other thing, the other congressional investigation that people, or that the news media has told about, it was a William Klinger's report that he published, or his staff published. It wasn't a government, but he was chairman of the Government Oversight Committee, but it was not a government Oversight Committee report. It was just from his own staff. And they interviewed two Park Police officers and one FBI agent. And I've written letters. So this thing was like 8 pages long with 4 pages of endnotes. I've written letters that are longer than that. It's just absolutely ludicrous. So that's our investigative history. First the FBI, second the FBI, third the FBI.
Wow. So now we're left to wonder, because I think a lot of people just always, I assumed it was the Clintons that knocked him off. Who would want him dead? Gangsters kill gangsters.
Yeah, well, a lot of theories about who killed him and why, and that's just beyond something that we can figure out. We don't know who killed him. We don't know why. We know that he was murdered, and we knew who covered it up. The FBI covered it up.
Well, there are some things that point to different things, Deanna, as to the may have been reasons. And Dave Martin's book touches on some of this. In the back, he talks about what Foster's murder may have been related to. And one of the things was, and we did actually find a document related to this, was child abduction.
Oh, gosh.
Patrick Knowlton and I went to the National Archives, and we were gathering documents even after the Independent Counsel closed office. Right. And one of the documents that we found, it was a cover sheet for something, but there was nothing else with it. It just was by itself, this one piece of paper. And it said on the piece of paper that it was it was the Child Abduction Serial Killer unit, and it said regarding Vince Foster's suicide. Now, that document has FBI letterhead on it. It says, "Child Abduction Serial Killer Unit and then it has the FBI seal, and then it has questions for a suicide expert, Vince Foster death investigation. Now, I have no idea why the Child Abduction Serial Killer Unit of the FBI was involved in the Vince Foster death investigation, but one of the agents assigned to the case was a guy named Jim Clemente, spelled C-L-E-M-E-N-T-E, and he has appeared on RT television and other places. He has a website, or he may still have a website, but he bills himself as a child abduction expert. So he was involved in the case. Why is he involved in this case if it's just a suicide? I have no idea. But there's other connections to Ghislaine Maxwell, who you know is associated with
right. Epstein.
Yeah, Epstein. And there were scraps of paper we found at the archives that had her father's name, Robert Maxwell, and they say he was an intelligence agent, and he wound up dead. But anyway, who knows? We don't know, but there's some clues around.
Hold those thoughts, we'll be right back.
It starts with you and me.
We all
can be heroes. If we take the lead to change the bad to good.
All righty, we are back with our guests, Hugh Turley and John Clark. And you were talking about this gentleman, and actually that this might be associated with Pizzagate. You were talking about a gentleman by the name of Clemente. Oh, my gosh. And Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, yeah. Robert, and Jeffrey Epstein. Gosh.
Right. Dave Martin's book has a chapter titled, Was Vince Foster's Murder Pizzagate Related?
Right. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, and then there's also there was a guy named Jim Norman who was senior editor at Forbes magazine.
Uh-huh.
And Patrick Knowlton and I had lunch with him in New York a few years ago. And he wrote an article for Forbes about some possible espionage related to Foster's death. And all of this stuff is actually, I have a website called FBICoverUp.com. But if Dave Martin, if you go to his website, DCDave.com, and put in any of these names, like Clemente or Maxwell or Jim Norman, you know, he has a search box on his homepage,
right.
And things will come up. But Norman wrote an article for Forbes magazine. He was a senior editor, and it got canned, and he got canned. And the article did appear in a kind of odd magazine called Media Bypass, which was kind of for people that were reading alternative news before alternative news was popular. And the article appeared there. But that opens up another possibility, that there was some espionage involved, because there was Norman said there were some transfers of money. Vince Foster's sister transferred money to, Vince Foster's wife, $283,000, shortly before his death. And then Foster was, and Ambrose Evans Pritchard also had written in his book, Ambrose wrote a book that covered this topic, and he mentioned that, Foster had bought tickets to go to Switzerland. He was supposed to have had an account there with $2.7 million in it that had somehow gotten cleaned out. And according to Norman, the money was transferred to the U.S. Treasury.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, none of this stuff has been investigated by independent counsels or the FBI or anybody. And, you know, I don't have subpoena power, so I can only tell you that there's that one document I found at the archives that had the child abduction thing on it with an FBI logo. The agent's name on that document was redacted, and then any of the pages that followed it were not there. It was just this page was there by itself.
Wow.
But it was in the papers from the Office of Independent Counsel. So, and that's where Clemente worked with Brett Kavanaugh. So.
Okay, so they work together. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I have documents with Clemente's name and Kavanaugh's name on the documents. Yeah, in fact, when Miguel Rodriguez had his meeting where he said the police brought the gun to the scene, that memorandum, Brett Kavanaugh was at the meeting. His name is on that. Brett, you know, was 29 years old, the same age as Christopher Ruddy, when he joined the Office of Independent Counsel. And these 29-year-olds have now become our Supreme Court Justice and the CEO of Newsmax.
Right.
So they move up, and they're still with us. It's very interesting.
And what is Patrick Knowlton doing now? What is...
He's living in Mexico now, and he's been a consultant. He moved down there a few years ago, but he still works in New York as a consultant in the hospital field.
Right.
Yeah. But we did the best we could, and John took this case because when Patrick, besides attaching the evidence to Starr's report that was written by Kavanaugh, John filed a civil case for Patrick for civil rights violation, because it's a crime to deter a witness from testifying.
Right.
And John can tell you the legalese for that. I'll let him maybe take the ball back about that civil suit, because we went all the way to the Supreme Court, and John, we didn't get anywhere, but we did the best we could.
Right.
Yeah, we did file a civil suit, and the primary count of the civil suit was conspiracy to interfere with civil rights, civil rights violations for two or more persons to conspire to deter a witness from testifying fully, fairly, and truthfully. And of course, Patrick was harassed beginning the same day that he received the grand jury subpoena, which was known only the FBI and the Office of Independent Counsel. Grand jury proceedings are secret. So we thought we had a pretty good case. And in fact, on the website, FBICoverUp.com, is the amended complaint. And it reads like a short story. It catalogs what we knew at the time of who was involved. And that would certainly include Dr. James Beyer, who was the doctor who performed the autopsy. And I don't know whether or not you've covered that, but the autopsy was essentially over by the time the police arrived to witness it. During the time that it was before the police witnessed it, Dr. Beyer removed the only evidence of the entrance room, the official entrance room, and the soft pallet. And had eight slides of the soft palate, which he sent to his lab.
Wow.
He said that the gunpowder could be seen mostly present.
Hold on, Joe.
All righty, let's get back to this really quick here. Our guest today are Hugh Turley and John Clark, who is an attorney, and you will want to look at the website FBICoverUp.com. This is just amazing information. Who knew when we were all looking, watching the Kavanaugh drama on TV? Who knew what was behind everything? And to hear this side of the story, this information, just, it's amazing. But continue from where you left off, John.
Well, I was just saying that where I left off was where I was talking about the autopsy, how
right.
It was over by the time the police arrived there to witness it. Dr. Beyer had taken out the only evidence of the official entrance wound, and he sent the slides to his own laboratory to inspect and apparently to report on the gunpowder debris that was supposedly on the soft pallet. And again, Dr. Beyer said it was grossly present, meaning that you could see it with the naked eye. However, the Virginia Medical Examiner's Office laboratory came back and said there was no gunpowder whatsoever
Oh my gosh!
That's what they came back and said. Although that report is withheld, but later on we did give an FBI lab report, which came out and explained, or tried to explain, give an excuse for the absence of any gunpowder on those slides of the soft palate. So that's how, that's the only reason we know that, about that. So there are really a number of different aspects to this case. I would hope that your listeners would go to FBICoverUp.com. We have a really an excellent video there that
right.
doesn't talk too much about the evidence, but it certainly is a good introduction as to what happened to Patrick Knowlton and why it is that he is was so important. And that appendix that I talked about that Ken Starr was ordered to attach to his own report, that is at the back of the book, the Murder of Vincent Foster,
right.
By David Martin, and it's also, of course, at our website. So,
right,
it's pretty pretty revealing.
Exactly, and just go up the top there, and wow, oh my gosh. This is just fabulous. All the things that you have online are just amazing. Just
well, yeah, we put it all there. It's all there. And there's a tab on the right hand side called Inside Stories. But all the evidence and all the things you what does it all mean? And
right.
John made a statement before, and I think Dave Martin also summed it up nicely in his book, although it's he does it in a poem at the end of the book. Earlier in the book, on page 170, he wrote this, and I think it sums up why this is important. He said, it all comes down to this. To believe Vince Foster was murdered is to believe that our government is corrupt to the core, and that what represents itself as a free and vital press is nothing more than a big propaganda machine. Put another way, so have the high have the stakes been raised in this case that one cannot have faith at all in our federal government and in our vaunted free press and still entertain the notion that Vince Foster might have committed suicide.
Right.
So it's really, John used to tell me when we were working on this thing with all these legal things, he'd say this could bring down the government. And indeed in France with the Dreyfus affair that David Martin compares it to, you know, the government had staked its reputation on this guy, Alfred Dreyfus, being guilty, and he was innocent, but they were just determined to stick it out. And that's where we are in this country. The government's reputation is, and both Democrat and Republican have staked their reputations on the fact that Foster committed suicide, and it's a big lie.
Right. You have a link about Justice Antonin Scalia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this Martin covers him really well in his book. Really.
And
well.
His death was questionable.
Yeah, that was odd. It was odd,
to say the least.
Yeah.
Yikes!
But he did his part in covering up the Foster death too.
Right. Oh, gosh.
John and I were, John, you were there that day when Alan Favish argued in the court. We were there, you and Patrick and I and Reed Irvine. We all sat together when Scalia called people conspiracy theorists.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Now, the one link up at the top, Inside Stories, is a must for the listeners to visit. It's FBICoverUp.com/inside-stories.html. So,
two of the things I mentioned are there, Deanna, the Jim Norman Forbes magazine, you can click, that's an interesting link there. And so is right below him, there's a link to that FBI document about the child abduction serial killer unit related to the Vince Foster death. Oh, and down below on that same page are all of Dave Martin's articles. Look at the
right,
list.
Right, right. Yeah, a long, long list.
He has written more about Foster's death than anybody in the country, or in the world, in the universe.
Wow.
Yeah, he's really written on, he is the guy to write this book, The Murder of Vince Foster, because he knows it so well, and he writes well. He can really
he
tell.
He does.
He tells the story.
He does. Wow. Amazing. A person could spend a lot of time on this website, learning a lot. Really an eye-opener.
Oh, thank you.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
You see Dean Arnold's book down there at the bottom.
I saw that, yes.
Yeah, it's all there. It's the most comprehensive thing you can find on it. And probably the most comprehensive book is Dave Martin's book. Dave Martin's book is so important, we put that on our homepage.
Right. I particularly like on the Brett Kavanaugh page, where you have an image of Brett Kavanaugh. I know you did this on purpose. His eyes are red. There's red dots. I know it's the camera, but it makes him look like a very evil devil.
Well, I actually took that photograph of Brett Kavanaugh at Yale University Law School, where he was giving a presentation, and I went up there. Patrick was with me, and I had my camera with me, and I walked up to the front, and he looked at me, and I took that picture.
Yeah.
One of those red eye pictures.
Yes, but he looks, it captures him very well, I think.
It does. I'll tell you what else is very fun to listen to. If you're at the Brett Kavanaugh page, at the bottom, there's an audio. Because I told you earlier that Reed Irvine taped all his phone conversations.
Right.
And he taped this conversation with Brett Kavanaugh. He talked to Brett twice, and it's all here. Reed Irvine was a great radio interviewer. Reed, if you go back to the very beginning of our program, he's the man that introduced me to David Martin.
Right.
So Reed interviews Kavanaugh after this report comes out, and he asks him, what evidence do you have that Vince Foster's car was at the park? And they go back and forth, and Reed just nails him down. And at one point, Kavanaugh admits that everyone at the park, all the police and firefighters, saw the brown Honda.
Wow.
And see, Foster's car with his silver gray, newer Honda. Actually, even was his car. That car was owned by his children. He drove a Lexus. But the kids, and his young kids, they were like 17, 19, and 21 or so, they drove this silver Honda. But they said that was his car at the park. But that car was never at the park. And Reed, in this interview with Kavanaugh, he just nails it. But the punchline is at the very end when Kavanaugh says, you don't tape these conversations, do you, Reed?
Oh.
He had realized he'd said too much. And Reed said, I tape virtually all my conversations.
Wow.
And Kavanaugh said, all your conversations? And Reed just laughed. It was too late because Kavanaugh had already admitted that
everyone
saw the brown car. And in his report, he wrote that Foster's car was at the park. And it wasn't. And that's why Patrick Knowlton was such an important witness. And what, fortunately, we got John Clark involved, who was such an excellent attorney. And
otherwise, what would have happened?
Yeah, all of us came together, I guess. So it went well. Reed and Patrick and John and Dave Martin and I, because we all kind of did our best to get the truth out.
And what would have happened to Patrick had this not occurred?
Oh, he said it changed his life. I mean, the day he went in that park, he said it changed his whole life. And same for me. When I walked into that park, it changed my life. It changed John's life, didn't it, John?
Absolutely. Let me tell you what happened when Patrick first got in touch with me about this. It was on a Thursday. I got a message. My girlfriend said that he called and he sounded like he was really worried. She sounded like he might have murdered somebody or something. Very distraught. So I called him on the phone, and I had to go out, and this was on a Friday, and I said, all right, well, I'll be over there about 5 o'clock when I get back from doing what I had to do, which I did. I walked in the door, and there was Patrick with Ambrose Evans Pritchard, and they gave me the short version of what it was that had just happened to Patrick and that he had been in the park. At that point, we didn't know why he was important. So first thing out of my mouth, I said, why don't you call the Washington Post? And so Ambrose rolled his eyes like, oh man, this guy's a rookie. So that was perfect. Also, I wanted to throw in that I said that we spent 18 months going through the 10,000 pages of records and just picking apart Kavanaugh's 114-page report. Well, our counter to that was 530 pages, and it had over 1,000 footnotes, all single-spaced. Of course, Kavanaugh's is 114 pages double-spaced. But in any event, that's on the website, and also, you know, all of the chapters, the beginning have summaries, so if somebody didn't want to wade through a 500-page document, they could just read the summaries at the beginning of every chapter, and there's also an excerpts of that document, which is 160 pages, a little bit shorter. It's got more than just the summaries in there, but that sort of gives you a good idea of what's in there. And we took that that document that we did, and we filed it in Patrick's civil rights case. We filed it with a special division for the purpose of appointing independent counsels, asking them to order Ken Starr to substitute our 20 pages for our 535 pages. We filed it in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is very pro-government, but we filed it and asked them we sort of recognized that the soft underbelly was the grand jury and that we wanted to get to the grand jury. So we asked the Special Division, the Eastern District of Virginia, and also the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia to order Ken Starr to present this evidence to the grand jury. But none of them, we were not successful in any of those. But in any event, that failure, we later published that as Failure of the Public Trust as a book. But the 535 pages was also filed in the U.S. Supreme Court, coincidentally.
Wow.
So it's part of the record there.
My gosh. Yeah, I'm looking at that that chapter, or that particular page. Oh, my gosh. And you give the diagram of the thing, and I just amazing. Amazing. Ah.
It's really It's really nice to have a radio host that still wants to talk to us. John did 150 radio shows at one point. He and Patrick were on everything back in the day when the Clintons were in office.
Oh, really?
There was a lot more talk radio back then.
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
There was that's sort of an understatement. I contacted, I mean, it was almost a full-time job getting on those radio shows. It was 140-some radio shows. And then in 1999, I went to Northern California to help out with as a volunteer to help with a civil rights trial. It was Judy Berry, versus, Frank Doyle and other FBI agents. And that was in Oakland, California. In any event, I had this big, thick file of all these talk radio shows I had been on. So I called every single one of them and not one of them was still in business. Every one of them had been bought up.
Oh my gosh! Well, that goes along with the media cover up that you've been explaining. That when you monopolize the media, you pretty much dictate what is true and what isn't. And thank goodness for RBN that it's still in existence.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's see, what page? On the Brett Kavanaugh page, right at the top, you have the image of the Supreme Court with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Of course, we know that she passed. And so that's, you know, they're trying to replace her, or they say they're trying to replace her, or, you know, you really can't believe what you hear on TV. I don't listen to TV. I haven't turned it on since March. It's just amazing all the things that you hear, just on the internet. And, oh my gosh. This just puts such a different spin on everything. But when you bring in Jeffrey Epstein and that, those possibilities.
Whatever got Foster killed was very dark. It was something very evil, and so evil that they don't even want people to know that he was murdered. So, because if he's murdered, the people know why. Well, why? And the why is probably something just horrible that they can't afford to tell the public what it was.
Wow.
It certainly wasn't because he knew too much. People always say, oh, maybe he knew too much. Well, but if he knew too much, who's he going to tell? You can't tell the press because we've been there.
Sure. Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and we've got about 3 minutes. Anyway, I really hope that people will look at that website, fbicover-up.com, and review all of the massive amount of information that you have there is just amazing. It's really amazing.
Thank you for spreading the word. But speaking of the word, I got to go back to one of Dave's poems before we close up.
Yes.
This is another one of my favorites. In fact, I memorized this poem. Some of them I really like. And this is one of them. It's called The News. And this is in his book, I'm sure, because there's so much of his poetry in the book, but it goes like this. The keepers of the knowledge gate demark the bounds of the debate and manufacture an illusion that we've reached our own conclusion. Certified is safe to know what is what they say is so. Thus they conquer and confuse and manipulate the news. Whoever wants to play the keeper climbs a slope that's ever steeper. And he who will not sell his soul needn't bother with the roll. But the lines are long enough of those who think they have the stuff to sell a fable as a fact and keep their consciences intact. We see their faces every night telling us that black is white. The paper at the breakfast table ought to have a warning label. Caution, what you read within is doctored with a careful spin. Lift your eyes and call a halt if you lack a grain of salt. I don't know how it got this way, and it gives me pain to say, we're not a land of liberty if it's truth that makes us free.
Wow.
News. That's a good one.
Dave always ended all of his programs with me with a poem, and so that's very appropriate and so true. The way he crafts those words together is just amazing. He's so gifted.
Well, if you go to his website, which is dcdave.com, he has his prose and his poetry.
Right.
And there's a lot of Foster material. He's written a lot of Foster articles, but he also has some excellent Foster poems that capture the truth. And he does it in a few words, so it's really a joy to have him on the team.
Oh, he's terrific. I've known him for a number of years, just in interviewing him, and have always appreciated everything that he's ever written or contributed to the program, and what an amazing amount of information you've put together, and it's so wonderful and enlightening to have people like you that care about the truth and risk things to tell the truth, to reveal those things that the news, quote unquote, won't reveal. That's remarkable.
Well, I think Dave's book really takes care of the news. I mean, if you want to know about the press in this country, this story really sums up our situation, which is not good.
Exactly. It is not good. But it is, so true. And he said it for years, but this book is the top of the mountain here. Thank you, gentlemen, for being on the program today. We'll have to do this again, okay?
Sure.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye now.